Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. And joining me now is someone I have not spoken with until right at the beginning. It was literally right at the very beginning. It was my first interview. It was my first week. And I suddenly thought, we need to catch up. It's been too long. Rodney Hyde, good morning.
Good morning, Marie. That was the first week.
It was. It feels like a lifetime ago, Rodney. What happened?
It does. And the funny thing is, we were sort of never nervous because we just did it.
Yeah. It's and I suddenly thought, we need to catch up. It's been far too long. And there were a lot of things that we talked about, and we talked about culture and all sorts of different things. And I thought today we could just have a good old chat because loads of water has gone under the bridge in the last 15 or so months. So the first place I want to kick off with is one of the things that you and I both love, and that's books. We're both voracious readers. And I think when we spoke last time, we were talking about The New Puritans by Andrew Doyle, and you were going to read it. What did you think? Because I know you have read it.
Oh, great book. In fact, if I could characterize the last 2 or 3 years, it would be me learning critical theory. Because I remember trying to do that in the 90s, early 90s, and just giving up because it struck me as totally insane. And I had a dear friend called Owen McShane. He said, you've got to get on top of this stuff because, you know, it's going to eat us. This is what they're teaching kids at university. Well, I stuck my head into it and I said, Owen, it is so insane, no one will buy it. They'll leave university, get married and have a mortgage, and they'll forget all about this rubbish because this is madness. And my interest back then was science. I was very lucky because through books, I'd been a student of the great Karl Popper. So I had a very good epistemology, well developed, by which I could understand science. And my other love was economics, and my goal was public policy, and it was always about government building a better mousetrap. So if you want to help the poor, how's the best way of doing it, right? If you want to save the planet, how's the best way of doing it? That was my absolute focus, and I had no interest in sociological claptrap, right? And the greatest claptrap of them all is critical theory. Well, what's it? 30 years on, bites you in the bum. Because suddenly this stuff is right through my kids' primary school, and it's driving the pedagogy in the primary school. The teachers don't realize it. They just mouth the stuff like, oh, this is what they say, and cool people say this, and we love Jacinda and she says it, so we just follow along. And that's when I felt 30 years late, I needed to get to this party. So I read that, and I did read Andrew Doyle's book, The New Puritans, which is a fabulous book, but also Lindsay's book, Cynical Theories.
With Helen
which
Cutgrass,
actually,
yeah.
And Helen Cutgrass, I always forget her last name. I actually enjoyed that book better, more.
Yeah, that was, so the Cynical Theories by James Lindsay and Helen Cutgrass, I think that came out in 2021. And that was great because it was quite, 21 or 22, and it was like a primer for the entire theory, wasn't it? I loved the fact that they both went into the complete history of it, and they showed how critical theory was the Frankenstein's baby that was created primarily from Marxist theory and postmodernism, as well as other influences in between. But it just gave you this beautiful timeline from how it began and how it started moving, especially through our institutions. Yeah, it was a really good book. Have you read James Lindsay's Race Marxism, which he's released since?
No.
I should send that to you. That's also very, very good. He dives into the Marxist elements even further.
Mm. Well, I'm a great student of Thomas Sowell, and he spent his early years as a Marxist. In fact, he finished his PhD under Milton Friedman and George Stigler, who are the two leading Chicago economists, free market, and he was still a Marxist. But he went off to, what was it, the Bureau of Labor Management or something in Washington, D.C., and the summer there cured him. And he's always done great work on race and Marxism and exposing how, well, the Marxists, having failed to excite the workers, decided to excite minority groups to make them victims. And of course, that's where it intersects with critical theory.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. And everyone has a philosophy, right? It's just not well thought through. And I have to say, reading about cynical theories does make you stop and think, because I can't understand how you could be at university department, university vice chancellor, school principal, a corporate CEO and board chair, and be in lockstep with that madness, which is so counter to your interests.
Mm.
They have no idea what they're playing with.
Oh, none whatsoever. And for those few that I think are aware, they believe that they are being good people, you know, by...
I think that's how it works.
Yeah.
You take a kernel of truth and a good cause and then twist it. So you say things like, oh, we're really interested in saving the planet. Suddenly it's climate change. Suddenly it's pay more for petrol. Suddenly it's you can't use petrol. You can't use fossil fuels. You have to deindustrialize and live as our peasant ancestors did. That's the implication. Or you say, oh, you know, we were so terrible to those homosexuals. We used to make it against the law. How terrible was that? Because they can't help it, you know. It's just they were born homosexuals. And so we just need to, you know, recognize that fact. And you say, yeah, yeah, I guess that's true. You know, it's pretty terrible that you'd treat all those famous homosexuals from history and they'd be locked up and persecuted and blackmailed. No, that's terrible. They couldn't do anything to it. And it's a funny thing to be born a homosexual, but yeah, no, I'm on board with that. You know, let's, oh, homosexuals want to get married. Yeah, no, they get married because, you know, they love each other. Why not? Why should it just be, you know, me and a girl? No, 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 that's okay. Suddenly, oh, now you've got men who want to be women and it's the same thing.
Mm.
No, it's not.
But that's where the Frankenstein baby comes in, doesn't it?
Yes.
Because you've got Marxism, which is all about power dynamics and control. And then you've got postmodernism, which wouldn't know a boundary if it tripped over it. You know,
no.
So then when you combine both of those things together and you teach people that there is no such thing as a boundary and that you can be, do, experience or function on any level, any plane, however you want, wherever you want, and you have this insane belief, and yet behind that you have the Marxist belief of, you know, victimizer and victim, oppressor and oppressed, and you put and you place everybody into little boxes, and then all of a sudden, once you think you have all of this freedom, you don't realize, from the postmodernist ethos, you don't actually realize that you've actually caught yourself into a trap. And that you need to be following all of these rules. And if you want to be and remain part of the in-group, if you want to remain and be, now what was, did we see it the other day, through empathy and kindness?
Oh, God.
We'll get onto that later.
Yes.
You need to, this is what you need to do. And here is this invisible set of rules. And guess what? We'll change them whenever we want to change them as part of the dynamic, just
so
to keep
attention.
You on your toes. Yeah.
So pay attention. But also, too, I think it's got two great things in its favour for young minds. One is it creates a superiority. So, oh, look at me. I care for these oppressed groups. What? You don't? So they feel great about themselves. Plus, it's lazy because there's absolutely no facts, no reason, no trying to understand the world. It's an entirely a fanciful product of your mind. So if you want to be, say, an economist or a proper social scientist or a physicist, you find facts are difficult things. Very, very hard to gather up. Very, very hard to interpret. Competing theories. Very hard to test and experiment with. But you have to do it, and it's hard, hard work. Oh, you'd be a postmodernist. Life is easy. And, of course, Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay show just how easy it was when they published their famous papers.
Oh, the grievance studies, I know.
And they wrote insane papers that you'd roll around the floor writing. They went out for peer review and were published, and they were entirely a joke.
Yeah. Have you seen the documentary?
No. I tell a lie. I did see it.
Yeah.
Yes, so, no, did you?
It's wonderful. So I saw it because I interviewed Mike.
And it was actually, I think I'm right. It was the documentary was sort of filmed real time when they were doing it.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. And so that's why they looked. They were laughing.
They were. It was hilarious.
That's too mad. That's too sane.
There was this wonderful scene, and they'd all been out for dinner, and I interviewed Mike Naina, who made the film, the documentary maker, and there was this wonderful scene. It was ended up being filmed on an iPhone because he said they'd all been out, and he said, look, we were all quite, you know, we'd had a bit to drink, and they'd gotten their first acceptance, and it's just – it is just an incredible film. And what they had to go to sort of, they suddenly realised that it wasn't going to be as straightforward as they thought. They did actually have to put quite a bit of work in. Yeah. And if people want some reference to this, you can look up the Grievance Studies of Fear. I've on my replays, I've got Mike Naina, who's the filmmaker. I've interviewed Professor Peter Boghossian and Helen Pluckrose, who are two of the three that were involved. And it just proved the fraudulent nature of the academy and that whole concept of idea laundering. And we see this idea laundering now coming up all the time. So that's where you have an idea that may be often a really bad idea. And in order to get that idea accepted, and you'll understand this from all your time in academia, is that you then need to reference that idea back to other papers and other work. So then what you do is you get all your shonky ideological mates to reference whatever the paper is that you wrote. And then before you know it, you get a snowball of references and it goes through sort of the ideological laundering factory and pops out as justified scholarship at the other end. Well, we've now seen that, haven't we, in this ideological critical theory space. We've seen it definitely in the trans space. If you read Helen Joyce's Trans, she covers that extensively. But COVID, I mean, look, they did exactly climate the change. Same with COVID. Climate change,
They have this gold standard of peer review, which is basically your mates checking it out and agreeing with it politically. And of course, the extraordinary thing about this critical theory, which I never thought would have been possible, but it's actually swamped physics, mathematics, history, biology, the Royal Society. So they're all doffing their cap, trying to out-virtue signal each other. I never would have thought a company like Air New Zealand would buy into it or Countdown. It's a frigging airline. Get me to point A to point B, cheap as possible, please. Maybe if it's a long flight, throw me a meal. Countdown, just have nice goods. You know, I'll do the rest. No. They've got a virtue signal. and you're paying for it. How is that possible? Why don't they concentrate on the business? How did you get into this, Marie? That's always puzzled me.
Oh, I got cancelled, Rodney. That's how I got into it. I mean, you know, when you step in dog duty, you've got to then study the dog. So that was pretty much where I came from. So, and the hand knitting, have you not heard about the hand knitting wars? Oh, Rodney.
No, not real, are they?
No. So when all of this critical theory and that whole cancellation culture was going, so it was in the academies, right, for quite a long time, and it stayed pretty much within that realm right through to about sort of 2015 or so. And then after 2015, it started seeping out into the real world. And some of the places that it seeped out to first were young adult fiction, gaming, and hand knitting. And because my...
And comedy.
Comedy was the other place.
And comedy's been really wrecked.
Really, really affected. And so...
But hand knitting, how did hand knitting...
Well, when you get hand knitting had a huge renaissance, particularly in the 2010s, and it is predominantly female dominant. And when you have a lot of highly educated, Western affluent white women, you put them all together and give them a keyboard and basically disaster ensues, Rodney. And it started, there were always these percolations of the theories of and the virtue signaling and all the different elements of wokeism, early wokeism, that were starting to pop out. So they would talk about, the whole dynamic of oppressor and oppressed and being a minority, and you need to uplift these voices and be kind, and you need to, and you can't, oh no, you can't gender that person, and all of those.
This was happening online in the knitting
space. This was happening online in knitting spaces, but it hadn't quite got to the cancel space yet, but there was lots of sort of, no, you can't say that. No, you don't say that. It's not inclusive to say that.
And you were like WTF all the time.
You know what? To be brutally honest, Rodney, I would see these things go on and I'd say, oh, it's a North American problem. It's not a New Zealand problem.
That's how I think.
So I ignored it. And then there was a woman her name was Karen Templar. And she was
called Karen. That's
Karen. I know the irony. She's actually a very nice lady. And I've got a swathe of teenagers coming and going right now. She's a very nice lady. And she she wrote a blog post because everyone was blogging in those days, darling. Everyone was blogging. And she was doing a blog post about going to India. And she was very, very excited about going to India. For her, it was a dream. She'd never been. She was really looking forward to going. She was talking and she wrote this beautifully written post, and she was talking about the experiences and the colours and the smells, and someone like her from Midwestern America, it would almost feel like she was an alien going to another planet. That's how she termed it. Oh my Lord, you would have thought that she had, would basically call knitting genocide. It was awful, absolutely horrific. The online space, they'd been primed with all their virtue signaling for a number of years. This blog came out. One of the key influencers in the group, in the space, basically deemed that she had created this massive offence, and a huge pile on happened.
So she offended someone?
She offended, well, according to them, she offended everybody because she likened Indian people to aliens.
Oh.
Which, of course, she didn't do. So this huge, big furore broke out. And then it just essentially went steadily downhill after that.
So a simile and a metaphor sort of passed them by.
Yeah, very, very much. And then it then followed on very soon after, because it just got very, very toxic. Any online space with these hand knitters, you had those who were educated and had put in the work and done the emotional labour on this.
Done the mahi.
And yeah, Yeah, and there was a whole vernacular. I mean, honestly, there was this whole vocabulary.
So this isn't just New Zealand. This is North America and Australia.
Predominantly North America, but there were a core of people here in New Zealand that were sort of quite tied in. Then there was another high-profile independent dyer in the US that said she needed to take a break. They went for her. And this whole time, I'm thinking to myself, this is a North American problem. It's not a New Zealand problem. Fast forward several years, and then because I run a high-profile online yarn business, you have an expectation is then set for things you must do. And for the first time I intersected with it was when I was getting pressure from some of these ideologues to put out a diversity statement on our website and in our store so people who come to our store will feel, in inverted commas, safe and welcome. My response to that, Rodney, was, well, we've got one. It's on the front, it's outside the front door and it says welcome.
We'll take your money. Whatever colour you are, whatever race you are, whatever sex you are, we don't care. We'll take your money.
Yeah, so
we've got great products.
So that to me, so for me, that was the beginning of the slippery slope. But there was a whole number of things that happened. But the final straw came in May of 2020 with the whole lockdowns, and it was actually during lockdown, and I could see by this stage what was going on with the lockdowns.
What was the foot?
What the motivation was, what was all the politics, theory and ideology behind it. And these women, you know, we'd gotten permission actually from MBIE to sell yarn, and I'd gone through the process. I'd dotted I's, crossed T's, done everything properly, and they went for me because that I was being socially irresponsible. And I'm like, I can't win with you women. I'm over it. I've had enough. So I went on to quite a podcast that was pretty well known within the alternative media and freedom space at that time. And I basically had a 90-minute rant, Rodney. And then it took them 3 weeks to figure out that I'd done it. And my 90-minute rant then turned into quite a massive cancellation and me having to get the police involved and NetSafe. And it was quite a to-do at that time.
It's a horrible thing. I had a very early blog as an MP, and I thought, what a wonderful thing. And I loved it because I thought, this is like a public square and you can just chat away and people can email you and you can chat away. In those days, we gave our phone number to everyone, our emails to everyone, never thought twice. And I loved it. And then you start to get people being nasty. And then I got a guy who was obsessed and threatening to kill. And you'd literally wake up in the morning and it was the first thing you'd see, right? Because go and check your computer, what's happening in the world. And this guy would be ranting. You know this guy isn't going to kill you, because if he was, he wouldn't be posting about it. And you knew that he was troubled and shouldn't count. Picture. But over time it does.
Mm.
And I just closed it down because I thought, I enjoy people, right? And you know, if you met this guy, he's probably a nice guy. And if you said boo to him, he'd probably jump away. But it's this online behavior where quite reasonable people get so nasty. I make it a policy always to post under my actual name. And I have to say, it always makes me think twice.
Mm.
The only thing I have got is I've got an X account that's under a pseudonym, but I don't post. But I did put a comment on Tahina Ray's post and it was cheeky. But because I think putting your own name and owning your words is a good moderator.
Yeah. It's so that, you know, that brings me to something that I want to get your thoughts on. And it's bringing things back to being in person, and here we are talking through Zoom, but in person, and the value of good old-fashioned manners.
Mm-hmm. Nothing matters more.
Yeah, but do you think that there is a lost generation now of young adults? And I know I work very hard with my sons, and so does my husband, to instill those manners, but there's a lost generation that they've actually not necessarily been taught the beauty.
I don't know. I got a funny double experience about that, because I spend an hour a day probably reading online. And I get a view of the world that is very negative and very dark. And I was reflecting on this and all the great loss of values and all the rest of it. And that day I had to drive over to Cromwell, pick up some chicken feed at Farmlands, and pick up some timber at Placemakers. And I didn't quite know what I wanted. I didn't quite know how I was going to get it. And I didn't quite know what I was doing. I couldn't have met nicer people in Farmlands. I couldn't have met better people at Placemakers. They were all wonderful, very helpful, very courteous. Complete opposite. Maoris they were, Indians, Islanders, right? Falling over to help you. And I thought, it's very easy to read stuff and the New Zealand Herald and a couple of blog spots and get a very dark view of human nature and the comments. So I find when I go out and about, I'm quite impressed with people. Now, I've got three young kids, two at primary school, one just started high school. Very impressed with their friends, actually. So I think we have a problem, no doubt, but human people one-on-one. I've noticed in cars, I've noticed people driving like maniacs, right, post the COVID era. And I wonder if that's a bit like online trolling, because you don't know quite who they are, particularly at night. But I find people one-on-one are very nice, but they're not good when they get on the computer, and they're not good when they get behind the wheel.
Mm, yeah, I agree. I think that in-person contact is so invaluable, and that's why, for me, the lockdowns were so pernicious.
Absolutely.
Because it pushed everybody into this online space, and good manners and propriety and actually just genuine humanity was lost.
Mm.
Just for a time, and it's getting that back. And yeah, I agree
with
you.
There is a post-COVID. It's like, you know, before Christ and after Christ. It's like a pre-COVID era and an after-COVID era, because it has had such a dramatic impact on the world. And I think even the pro-lockdowners feel it. Something's changed. And it was this massive government overreach and the legitimizing of being nasty, where you could pot your neighbor, where you could scream at someone because they came within 2 meters, when you could be extremely rude to someone because they wouldn't wear a mask, where you could despise and hate on someone that hadn't had the jab, where you could call the thousands of protesters at the parliament a river of filth, where the media joined in the pile-on and every public figure joined on the pile-on. That was shocking. By the way, I think it's reflected in the war in Gaza, because I can't believe the extent to which people support Hamas or excuse Hamas and spend their days criticizing Israel from our government down, because that's so perverse. The Israelis were minding their own business and they came under attack. They had hostages taken. What are they supposed to do?
Do you think that comes from a naivety because people don't read history anymore?
Extreme ignorance and naivety, but also that quick to condemn. And if they see someone condemning someone, they pile on. It's like I'm a lefty. If Jacinda tells me to hate someone, I'll hate them for her. If she tells me that plastic straws are bad, I'll hate plastic straws. It's sort of like a little, if they tell me Biden's a very clever man when the door's closed, I'll believe them. And he is. And of course, that portrayal of Israel as a colonial power and these poor indigenous assets, which is so absurd that only a green MP could believe it. But it's widespread. Very, very widespread. And you do think, how could you be a breathing sentient person? I find that one extremely upsetting.
Mm. Did you read Matthias Desnet's Psychology of Totalitarianism? When it came out, you will love that book, Rodney. You will add that to your list.
Okay.
That, to me, you know, that missing piece when you saw all that behavior, you know, that it's almost like a hypnotic trick where someone went like this and people started acting really erratically. And we, as you said, as you outlined during COVID, And again, you see it with the war in Gaza, you see it with climate change, you see it. It's almost like these weaponized grievances that people, it's like, what is the grievance this week that we have to get exercised and weaponized about? And it changes and it moves. And it's the same group of people and the same group of actors who, I mean, I'd hate to take their blood pressure because they must be, they're continually angry and on edge all the time about everything.
The funny thing is, if you stand up to them, A, we know they have no argument, and B, they either wilt or get angry because they have no discussion about Israel or my daughter's 13, and I'll get into trouble for this, but she, in an exam script, she's supposed to write something about inclusion, and she wrote the phrase that she didn't want to be discriminated against it because she was a woman and didn't have a penis. And the teacher wanted to talk to her ostensibly about using the word penis, which is very funny because we know what goes on in their relationship and sex education stuff. But it was more about there are women who do have penises. And my daughter just did the death stare and said, no, they're not.
Yeah, good on
her. The teacher couldn't push it because there is no argument, right? There is no argument. A woman, by definition, doesn't have a beanie.
let's head into kids and raising resilient kids. Because you've got your three kids now, and then you've got the older kids too. Is that right?
An older one.
An old one, yeah. So what's different? raising is, yeah. So, I mean, talk me through that, because that must be fascinating, parenting in two different decades and generations.
Yeah, so my oldest son is more than 20 years older than my next child. And that's almost a complete generation. So it is night and day. And I think the biggest hurdle that we have is that it has changed so dramatically that people don't believe it. And I'll give you a great example. I've recently had a to-do, not in a nasty way, but, you know, a please explain with the school over sex education. Because you and I, being aware of critical theory, are awake to this stuff. So when my son had sex education at his school, they put on an evening or two, I can't remember, and the parents went along. Which, funnily enough, I was a little uncomfortable with. But you had to be there. And because it's a bit embarrassing, right? But I thought, well, this is cool because, you know, we're getting a bit of a message. And it was strictly biological. Basically, this is how babies are born. Fast forward 20 years. Oh, we're going to do a bit of relationship and health stuff. It's compulsory. And we'll be showing videos and going through some scenarios and workshops with your child. I wrote and said, great. Can I see it? It's copyright.
So it's okay to show it to your child, but it's not okay to show it to your child's parent.
Mm.
Oh.
So I had to go to the expense of buying it. It's put out by Family Planning, who are a seriously dangerous organisation now, whatever they're called. They've got some Maori name. Horrific. This stuff is horrific. Can I make your readers blush for a moment?
Rodney, believe me, with the content on the show, fill your boots, Tiger.
The male teacher was part of this curriculum, is teaching my 13-year-old daughter how to do anal sex, how to submit to it, how to ensure that she doesn't get a sexually transmitted disease, and how she doesn't tear a bum.
At 13?
Mm-hmm. By a male teacher. Now, to be fair, when I suggested to the principal that this wasn't exactly appropriate, oh, we're not showing that particular video. Well, actually, there's two of them. And the rest of them are just as bad. It's just that one so hits you in the face, right? I was going to write to the male teacher and say, oh, dear Mr. So-and-so, I see you're teaching my daughter about anal sex. Perhaps we should meet first. He couldn't meet me, could he?
Hmm.
So, no consent, no ability of parents to find out, and they tell you it's compulsory, as in I explained, Parliament explicitly says it's not. You can opt your kids out. And so I did. And then I said, oh, I see Parliament also required that you to do a review of this with parents. Community consultation. When was your last one? And they've come back and said, funny, you've asked, we've got one coming up next term. Didn't tell me about the last one. They've never done it, of course. And I said, well, how are you going to do consent when the material's copyright? And you're not allowed to show it. This is what's going on in our schools compared to 20 years ago.
Oh, look, I remember for us, there was a consent form that had to go home and that we were entering into, you know, sexual and reproductive education. And there were a number of girls actually at my school, because the school that I went to was by the Closed Brethren Church. And this was before they had their own school. So the kids were mainstream then. And they, all those mums came in and those girls sat out. And I mean, honestly, the most funky dunky thing we did in the class was put a condom on a banana. So, you know, there was no, it was, we talked, we all girls' schools. So we obviously talked about the, our, most of the girls were menstruating. So we ran through that. And that was pretty much the sum total of what was covered.
Well, I had sex education in 1972. We had none.
Yeah.
The sex education was a biology book. And everyone had skipped ahead and read the chapter on human reproduction and looked at the organs and giggled and giggled and giggled. We were 14, boys and girls. And we had this teacher teaching us. And we spent a lot of time on how rabbits have little rabbits. We even dissected a rabbit to see how rabbits have little rabbits. It was amazing. And then she ran out of time and she slammed the book shut and yelled out, "And humans are the same." But, right, where's it come that suddenly kids need to be taught by strangers at school about these most intimate and personal things? Generations have got by, right? And this stuff that they're teaching now is totally amoral. It's without any self-respect. One of the great things that's happened to me since we've spoken is I've been along to two presentations by Let Kids Be Kids. And I went to two because the first one was so good and I thought a lot of this has passed me by. And Penny Marie gives you the overview of what they're doing in sex education. But she had met Elizabeth Cave in Hokitika and she had joined. Elizabeth Cave's presentation is the most dramatic and shocking thing I've learned about what's going on in our schools. Elizabeth was trained as a school teacher in the old style and used to write training manuals. And she goes through mental health. And you think about this. She explains us what's happening in our schools is we have what's called a hyper-focus on sexuality and race. And there's no attention paid to, say, character, your core beliefs, your humanity, or what you can do. So when I went to school, public state school, character was a big thing. Developing your character so that you tell the truth, that you'd be a good person, that you wouldn't be a snitch, you know, just you could be relied upon. No one gave a toss what colour you were, who your great ancestors were. No one gave a toss. We never heard of that homosexual stuff. Now it's endless. And that's why the kids are confused. That's why they're anxious. That's why they're depressed. Because the schools aren't developing character.
Yeah. See, my boys are at faith-based schools. I've got them with the Catholics. And actually that Catholic character, even though we're not Catholic, is great because it gives the boys a focus around trust.
Absolutely.
Loyalty.
Absolutely.
Support, you know, courage.
Absolutely.
You know, all of those.
Oh, I wasn't a Christian when I was on your show last, and I am now.
Rodney, you found the Lord.
Indeed.
Well done. Congratulations. Mm. You're enjoying the openness. What are you enjoying most about finding faith this time or now, really?
I've been an atheist since I was 7. I'm 68 or so. I could be 67. I can't remember.
It was such a long time ago when you came out fully formed, Rodney.
I love the most that what I thought was a beautiful world is even more beautiful. That I spend a lot more time trying to make myself a better person than make everyone else be better people. I love forgiveness, which I never could do. But most importantly of all, I love the sacredness. So if you're an atheist, like I was, your children are just clever little animals, as you are. And your marriage is an agreement to stick together while you can. Become a Christian, and your children are sacred. Your marriage is sacred. Everything changes with that view. Everything changes. And you go through your life not feeling lucky, but feeling blessed. And the funny thing is, my religious view isn't, quote, my belief, because it's true. So, it's rocked my world. And it literally happened in a heartbeat, not by some great revelation, but a total realization that this was true. Isn't that extraordinary?
Well, being someone who was an atheist for such a long time and now...
Only 60 years.
Yeah, and now you have faith. Do you think that the fact that our society has become increasingly more godless has actually allowed the likes of critical theory to seep in, because faith in itself was a balm or an inoculation to what are really, really bad ideas?
Totally. And in fact, it's that great line, isn't it? That if you don't believe in God, you'll believe anything. But I don't regard my belief in, or my discovery that Jesus Christ lived and died for us, regarding that, realizing that's true. I haven't adopted that position as a counterweight. I think what happened was I started to think about it in those terms because I asked myself, what sort of person would take a 11-year-old girl and try and teach her that she could be a boy inside, and that the best way, if that's the case, for her to proceed is to take puberty blockers and have her breasts cut off. Not so much focusing on the person, but the idea. Where would that idea come from? That that's a good thing to implant in an 11-year-old girl, because this is what happened to my daughter. And at 13, that she'd be taught what we discussed earlier. Mm. And I realized that's unmitigated evil. This isn't a discussion about, oh, does the vaccine work? Or what's the infection fatality rate of COVID actually? Or is the planet warming? No, this is basic view of humankind. And to be doing that and targeting children, to me, is unmitigated evil. And as soon as I saw that, I went home and got a Bible out and started reading it and thinking about it and realized it was true. I didn't realize it was true from the point of view of, oh, well, this will solve all these problems. I actually realized it was true. And you're right, because I had the luxury of being an atheist living in a Christian society. Now I know what it is to live in an atheist society, and it's horrid. Because your kids going to a Catholic school learn that there's something bigger than government, bigger than Jacinda Ardern, and that how they behave when no one's looking and won't get caught still matters. Very important.
Yeah. Well, and
it's a big thing. And that's why I am a big supporter of what Brian Tamaki's doing. Because he's the only public figure standing up for our kids. I'm a member of Let Kids Be Kids, but we're not public figures. But Brian Tamaki is, and he's confronting it and physically dealing with it, physically going to the libraries and stopping them, physically getting rid of the rainbow crossings, physically doing it with his menfolk. And that's what we all should be doing, because we should be protecting our children's innocence, not throwing it away. I believe that of critical theory, that we're dealing with, is the biggest challenge to whether our society will survive.
Yeah, it's having those people that are captured in that hypnosis and having them wake up, but also too for those of us who are very aware of what's going on, making sure that we are active in our kids' education and creating resilience in them for when they move forward. And I have to say, you know, the kids, while we've been doing this interview, a whole flood of them have come through. I always make sure that we have an open door policy. I want as many kids through this house as I possibly can, because they need to be in person. They need to spend time together. And they need to create that character. And it's funny, you know, both our boys have grown up, you know, their dad's an atheist. I'm like what you would call a Christian adjacent agnostic. And it's funny, our oldest son is in year 13, his next brother down's year 12. They've been in faith-based schools right through their high schooling. They actually enjoy the RE. They actually really quite enjoy it. Which is great. It's really fun to see.
I wish I had more time in a day simply to read the Bible. And I've got a big companion that discusses the issues as you go through. And I love theological debate, which I can't believe. I just love it. I can't get enough of it because I feel so new to it.
Mm.
And none of that shakes me. I've listened over and over to C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, as an audiobook at night in the darkness. And I regarded myself as being reasonably familiar with ethics and moral philosophy. When you come across a Christian view of morality and ethics, you realize you knew nothing, because this stuff goes back a long way and it's deep. And he does acknowledge the Greeks, right? But with a Christian perspective. And I can't get enough of it now. And dear readers send me books to read, and I'm just loving them. I discussed whether there was a Trinity or not with Ashley Church, and I got sent a wonderful book that I've read on why there isn't a, don't upset your boys, why there isn't a God, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. There's just God, which sounds silly, right, to have that debate, but I love it. It's a bit like the argument, I love Shakespeare, love his work. Love it. It's the greatest words ever written in English by a country mile. And I love the debate that it wasn't written by Shakespeare. It was the Earl of Oxford. And I can read about that all day and all night because it so clearly was the Earl of Oxford. And the idea that William Shakespeare wrote that, those plays and those poems, is so absurd as to be only an academic could possibly believe it.
Well, I'm just looking at the time, Rodney. You and I could keep going for hours, and I'm actually going to be down in your direction very soon, so hopefully we can do this in person, which will be absolutely delightful. Well, I'm going to do – it was interesting what you were saying in terms of finding faith and the fact that there is that one thing that is bigger than you and learning and accepting that. And to quote Qui-Gon Jinn from Star Wars, as he said to Obi-Wan Kenobi, there is always a bigger fish.
Always. And
always. So it has been so good to catch up. It's been far too long.
Well, I'm sorry because I forgot about our dear listeners.
This has been about you and I. They can come along on our journey. I don't mind. But we do need to remind people, we do need to do the thing that pays the bills. And we have to remind people, of course, that they're going to find you on Real Talk. When are they going to find you on Real Talk twice a week?
Oh, 10 to 1, Tuesday and Thursdays. And my format thus far is to have really a couple of long form interviews. And a lot of it's been because I'm not that interested in politics or economics. A lot of it has been in alternative health and the idea that we should be looking after ourselves rather than just turning up to the doctor when we're sick. And practical things like gardening and how to raise hens, which I'm now doing. So it's stuff like that. It's completely outside of my experience, and I'd never gardened. And we have a gardening show, and people have enjoyed it because we got a gardening guru, Wally Richards, on, and I pester him with questions about how you get gardening. And even experienced gardeners like it because he's a wealth of knowledge. So that's what we do. And we do cover the culture wars and the COVID experience and the COVID inquiry. And what's coming next? Because there's no doubt in my mind that locking us down and jabbing us up was just the start to what's coming. And this is why I love RCR so much, because they were able to isolate us. And when I say they, I mean all the tyrants tyrants in the courts, tyrants in parliament, the tyrants in all the government departments, the tyrants in the legacy media. They were able to isolate us. But with Voices for Freedom and with RCR, we're now a community. And we all got different views and we all disagree, but we're respectful. But we know one big thing, and that is that we desperately need individual autonomy. And we will fight for it.
Yep, we will. And so, Rodney, it has been a joy, as always. So this has been Rodney Hyde. Remember, Real Talk, 10 till 1 Tuesdays and Thursdays. And look, go and grab yourself a quick cup of tea and a tinkle, because Marty's going to be along next here with Media Matters on Counterculture here with Marie. Yeah, Marty's great. And hopefully I'll see you very soon, Rodney. Thank you so much for the time this morning.
Bring your woolen underwear.
Yes, indeed. All right, take care, Rodney. Thank you.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.